Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 8th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. Today he will be continuing his series entitled, Is the Religious Right Wrong About Family Values? Today's session number is 8, and is titled, Myths and Meanness, Blaming the Poor, Part 2. Let's listen in.
My name is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. This is the 4th in 5-part series on why families and children are in crisis and the relationship between children in crisis and broader societal issues, and basically what we would do differently as parents and as a society if we care about children. And tonight, we're going to focus on some very, very hot, controversial, difficult issues. And the way that I envision tonight going is I'm going to start you out in small groups of about 3 or 4, and I'm going to give you 2 questions, but I'm going to give them to you one at a time. So 2 kind of things to think about. And again, if you would get in groups of no more than 4, certainly, so that you all have a chance to talk and share, then we'll have a time when you can I'll stop you after about 6 or 7 minutes and give you the second question. Have you think about that together, and then we'll report back on both questions. Then it's my intent to present a little information, basically in relation to what you shared, and then we'll have a significant block of time for conversation, dialogue, questions, that kind of thing. So the first question I would like you to deal with, and again in groups of 3 or 4, is I want you to try to name as many of the assumptions that are driving the welfare reform debate. The reform of welfare is something we're going to talk about. It's probably, in my view, it's a good idea to reform welfare. But I would say that for reasons very different than many of the reasons that are being given for why we need to reform welfare. And depending upon how we look at what our assumptions are about what the problem with welfare is, will determine whether or not we end up with a welfare reform that punishes people or a welfare reform that offers people, I think, the hope for a different kind of future. So I want you, to both share your own opinions, but also to try to get your pulse on what's going on in the society about what is it? I mean, why all of a sudden in the last 2 years or 3 years have we had such a tremendous emphasis on welfare reform? And what assumptions do you hear about that program and about the recipients that are driving present efforts to reform welfare? Okay, so that's your first task. And I will interrupt you in about 6 or 7 minutes. So maybe if you'd even have someone in your group kind of jotting down some of your ideas for when we report back. No more than 4, because I want report back on this question, and then I'll give you the second question that you'll deal with in your small groups again. So don't wander too far from your groups. Okay, what were some of the assumptions that are driving the welfare reform debate that you can just throw them out in a brainstorm?
It costs too much money as far as our national budget is concerned.
Okay, so it costs too much. Thank you. What else?
A large proportion are employable.
What's that?
A large proportion of the people are employable.
Okay, so behind that would be employable people aren't working.
It sustains a lifestyle.
Okay. Welfare sustains a lifestyle that makes you don't have to work?
Right, yes.
The generation after generation.
Lifestyle that discourages work. Okay, generational dependency and poverty.
It's anti-family, the structure of the nuclear family, the way it's set up.
Okay, so welfare is anti-family. And say more about why. Can you just add a couple words?
It drives a male presence out of the house.
Okay.
Encourages young girls to get pregnant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Encourages teen pregnancy or out of wedlock birth.
It's inefficient, riddled with fraud.
Okay.
on both ends, those administering it and those figuring out how to
beat this scam.
Have a few.
Okay.
Losing self-respect.
Okay, losing self-respect.
The people on it don't know how to have poor money management skills, don't know how to be frugal.
Okay, so poor skills to use the resources given or to use the money properly.
That it's racial.
Okay, what that this is, say another word.
Oh, no, that it's mostly just black.
Okay.
Women.
It's just racist.
Okay, so that basically, one way of saying this would be that a lot of middle class white taxpayers are subsidizing blacks and other people of color.
Mm-hmm. People in this country should be self-sufficient.
Okay.
The people who really need it, like the kids, aren't always the ones that get it.
What was the one over here first, Dave?
People in this country should be self-sufficient.
Okay.
Shouldn't be getting handouts.
And what was that? Was the other one?
The children who really need it are sometimes the last to get it.
Okay.
Children who need it.
There are jobs out there that pay a living wage, but they're too lazy to go after them.
Okay. So that...
There are a sufficient amount of jobs that will pay a living wage.
Okay.
But minimum wage and welfare is not a very big difference between them. They are getting their benefits taken away too, but they are.
Okay, we'll talk about that in a minute.
Politically, the states can do a better job than Washington.
Okay.
Too much variability among states.
Illegal alien issue.
Okay, and what does that basically come down to? We're encouraging illegal aliens to enter the country because of our welfare system.
Yeah.
Entry drawn by. Okay.
It is assumed that if we cut off welfare, it will motivate people to get jobs.
Okay, motivation. Good.
The assumption that everybody on welfare has health care as a right?
The assumption, you think that's motivating the present debate, that everyone on welfare has a right to health care? Or is that something that you would hope would be part of it?
Well, it is part of it.
People in our group think it is part of it.
Okay.
That's a good answer.
Restate it. The assumption that people who receive welfare
have health care.
Okay, that they have health. Okay, I got it.
Free health care.
So the assumption is people who are receiving welfare have all kinds of other benefits like health care.
Right. And some middle class people don't.
Okay. So there's really an issue of frustration again among certain classes of people who are not recipients of welfare.
A recipient will continue to have more children just to get more money.
Okay. Money equals more kids.
People with food stamps buy better groceries than the average citizen.
Better groceries.
I hear that all the time.
Okay, let's just do one more. We could go probably on and on, but I'm running out of board space.
A basic underlying assumption is that money's the problem and money's the solution. It could be true, it could be false, but it's an assumption.
Okay, now I want to have you break into, we'll come back to these, or at least to some of them. Now I want to have you in your small groups deal with this thorny question. Why are people of color disproportionately poor and in prison in the United States? Okay, why are people of color disproportionately poor? We'll talk in a few minutes about how really a significantly larger number of Caucasian or white people are poor in this society than people of color. However, in terms of percentage of population, people of color are disproportionately poor relative to their percentage of the population. Why is that? And why are people of color disproportionately filling our prisons? Okay, there's your question.
Color is non-white?
Yeah, I'm talking about African Americans, Native Americans.
Asian?
Okay, hold on to your thoughts from that last discussion for just a couple minutes, and I want to spend a few minutes talking about some of these. And let me just start off first by saying, in terms of the assumptions about welfare reform debate, that there are some things that the most radical African-American political organizations in the country would agree with some aspects of the Newt Gingrich argument about welfare. That may surprise you, it may not surprise you, but they would agree, for example, that welfare has largely been anti-family. They would agree that it takes away people's self-respect. They would agree that it fosters a kind of dependency. They would agree that it locks people into poverty rather than freeing them from poverty. So there's some points we're giving. If you were to talk to many welfare recipients, and some of you work with welfare recipients, I've heard you in previous sessions, many of them have a pretty harsh critique of the way that the system functions. So the issue here is not whether or not welfare needs to be reformed. I think my own view is it does. I think most welfare recipients would say that it does. Newt Gingrich says that it does. And radical African-American organizations would say that it does. So there's some points of contact. Having said that, let me return, and I won't touch on all of your assumptions, but I just want to highlight a few and then offer just a few countervailing arguments. And again, I'll just tell you, some of you I know have got this book, but I go into much more detail about these questions than we can possibly do tonight. Okay, first assumption I would say is that people on welfare are lazy and they don't want to work. I think that's a pretty deep-seated fundamental assumption that's been driving the present welfare debate. Welfare is like a magnet, attracting and rewarding those in our society who don't want to work. So that would cover the illegal alien argument and lots of other things. It's like a magnet that just attracts people who aren't willing to work. Welfare encourages out-of-wedlock births and single-parent families. In other words, one reason that young girls get pregnant is to receive AFDC funds, and welfare, in fact, is a public subsidy of immoral, irresponsible behavior. I think that's a fairly common assumption. Welfare encourages dependency rather than rewarding initiative. Welfare encourages the breakdown of the family and causes poverty. Eliminating welfare or reforming it in ways that enforce responsible behavior will reduce poverty and related social problems. So if we dismantle the welfare system or change it dramatically in a direction that holds people accountable for their personal activities, it will have many, many positive social benefits, including the reduction of poverty and related social problems. And then another one is that the high costs of welfare and other social programs are bankrupting the country, driving up the deficit and putting our economic future in jeopardy. Now, we could add more, and you've listed some very good ones too, but I think there's an interesting mix in these assumptions that deal with a concern about morality and a concern about economics, okay, in terms of consequence. Well, without trying to, first of all, let me tell you that there are, in my view, there are some seeds of truth in some of those arguments. It's not, that's what's dangerous about stereotypes or myths or whatever, is they usually do contain kernels of truth. And again, it would be a much more nuanced discussion probably than we're going to be able to have tonight. And I will just tell you that when I dealt with chapters that dealt with these issues and then the question that I asked you to think about it a minute ago, it's very, very critical that we talk openly about those issues, but how we do so really matters, and it's a kind of, again, nuanced conversation that's hard to do in a short period of time. Okay, just a couple of rebuttals of some aspects of this that I think are very important. Number one, it seems to be largely absent from the welfare debate just what's happening to wages in the United States. And the fact that increasingly we have a two-tier economy in which about a third on up of workers actually have lots of potential, lots of possibility, good possibility for movement, good jobs, good benefits, etc. You have a real vulnerable group in the middle, and then you have lots and lots of low-wage jobs. One out of every five U.S. citizens that work full-time earn poverty-level wages. That's amazing to me. One out of every five full-time workers that works full-time in this country is living in poverty. The fastest growing segment of children who are poor are living in households where at least one parent is working full-time. So that tends to make a welfare reform in which you're attempting to push people into the workplace really quite questionable in terms of how that's going to deal with people in terms of real issues of poverty. Certainly the increase in the modest increase in the minimum wage that we had is helpful, but it's not nearly enough in terms of wages. An example from Minnesota, it's estimated that Minnesotans seeking livable wage jobs outnumber job openings 6-1. 6-1. And in this study, they defined, and I don't know, I'd be interesting to see how many of you actually live on this amount. It defined a living wage job as a $20,000 per year income for a family of three. So that's pretty modest, I would say. And it said that between 1990 and 1993, only 53% of the jobs created in Minnesota, 53% of the jobs created in Minnesota in those 3 years, that's the most recent statistics, were low-paying service sector jobs averaging $12,800 a year income. So it's a very important thing. When I won't go into this tonight, I go into it in a lot more detail in this book. I talk about the likely outcomes and already evidence of outcomes of approval of things like the North American Free Trade Agreement, the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade. These international agreements are tending to drive wages down in this country for significant numbers of U.S. workers. And one example from my experience in Central America is a couple of years ago, U.S. Magazines were taking out ads, U.S. companies were taking out ads in various journals saying, you can hire Rosa Martinez to sew for you in El Salvador for 57 cents an hour. After the approval of the North American Free Trade Agreement, within a year, the same exact advertisement was promising that you can now hire Rosa Martinez for 33 cents an hour. So that's what's happening. As long as that's true, it really challenges the idea. And when I was in Montana, Ron, you were there at this conference, one of the things we heard over and over again from welfare recipients and those who work with welfare people, for people who are on welfare, is that most of them want to work. But if they took the jobs that are available, they lose access to health care. They actually put their children in greater risk. Okay. Another one, I'm not trying to be too comprehensive here, but just touch on some very important issues. Very important study done by the Center on Hunger, Poverty, and Nutrition at Tufts University looking at welfare. They noted a couple of things. The assumption is if you offer more benefits, you're going to encourage more out-of-wedlock birth, right? In fact, if you look at the United States and the 50 states, the states with the highest incidences of out-of-wedlock birth are the states that pay the least dollars for welfare. So you, in fact, have the opposite being true. The states that are the most stingy in terms of their welfare payments have the most out-of-wedlock birth. And the reason for that is fairly clear, that to at least a certain extent, out-of-wedlock birth is linked to factors of poverty and other kinds of things. Okay, but that's only to a certain extent. That's the second thing they point out. They point out that nearly two-thirds of the increase in female-headed households over the past several decades were among the non-poor. In other words, there are lots of other societal factors that are encouraging women to have children who aren't necessarily in committed marital relationships. And most of those, two-thirds of them, are not among the poor, they're among the non-poor. And this would be true throughout European countries as well. Actually, as economic security has gone up for women, it's given women greater independence to think about having a family, even if there isn't a long-term relationship with a male partner. They point out that countering this idea that you live a good life on what you receive in welfare, and again, this argument that if we pay more, that's what's going to cause an increase in out-of-wedlock birth. They point out from 1970 to 1990 that out-of-wedlock births increased by 65%, while benefits decreased over 35%. So AFDC family benefits fell during that time from $644 a month to $417 a month. Now, if the conservative argument would hold, you would say, well, as these welfare benefits have been going down, then out-of-wedlock pregnancies will go down. In fact, the opposite has happened. Okay, so that's just another. Penelope Leach, who I mentioned a couple of times, she notes that in many U.S. states where out-of-wedlock births are a very real problem, again, are the states that are the most stingy in terms of their welfare benefits. And she also points out that in states like Mississippi and others, for example, if you have a second child on welfare, you know how much that increases your earning power? Think of those of you who are raising children, think about this. It's $10 a week. $10 a week. Now, there's a big incentive. I mean, as a parent, boy, I'm thinking about having 15 or 20 kids, you know? I'm thinking $150 more a week what I could do with 15 or 20 kids, right? So there are other factors, it seems to me, at work. Another one, the idea of costs. And I'm not going to say too much about this because I think the costs that matter are the ones that I just alluded to very briefly, and that is, I don't think it's a good system. I gave you the statistics that compare the United States with Sweden and Germany and France and how we do so poorly relative to other countries, breaking out of the cycle of poverty, lifting children out of poverty. That really matters to me. But in the present public debate, the idea is that really it's bankrupting the country. And I mentioned last time that 46% of the voters in the November 1994 election thought either welfare or foreign aid were the number one budget items in the federal budget. They, in fact, are less than 1%. By way of comparison, the federal government contributes about $13 billion a year. That's its contribution to AFDC, aid to families with dependent children, about $13 billion a year. The Central Intelligence Agency budget is $29 billion a year. The home mortgage deduction for those who write off interest payments costs the federal government $51 billion a year, about three times the federal contribution to welfare. Now, let me just say, and I lay this out in here, that I actually think the federal deduction for home mortgage interest payments is a good program, but I think it should be means tested. And for example, if you just limit it, put a cap on so that rich people buying homes can only write off $25,000 a year of interest. Pretty generous, it seems to me. You would save the federal government $28 billion a year. That's more than the entire cost of food stamps. Now, in this book, I give example after example after example after example that indicates, again, that the problem with welfare isn't that we're spending too much and we're bankrupting the country. It's where we're spending. It's who's getting benefits. And it's that we're not spending enough in areas that really matter in terms of children, families, and the well-being of our neighborhoods and our society. Okay, and then I could just, one other one that I can't pass up. We're going to have a forum tonight dealing with peacemaking. I would just point out that the United States Between 1947 and 1991, spent more in military budgets than the total value of all U.S. industry and infrastructure. All of our roads, all of our railroads, all of our infrastructure, and all U.S. industry, the total value of that, we spent more than that in the military sector, just by way of contracts.
What was the time span on that?
From 1947 to 1991. Okay. Now I'd like you just to lift up, how do you explain disproportionate poverty among people of color, and particularly among, and disproportionate imprisonment, particularly among African Americans, but also other people of color? How do you explain that? Why is that?
Schools aren't good.
Schools aren't good. What else?
Lack of opportunity.
Lack of opportunity.
Racism.
Racism.
No positive male role models.
No positive male role models. Thank you.
Loss of harassment by the police.
Harassment by police.
Loss of hope.
Loss of hope.
The fact that such a disproportionate number of the minorities live in communities of such acute despair.
Okay, that figure that I gave yesterday, it didn't occur to me until afterwards that maybe it needed some interpretation. I mentioned Jonathan Kozol notes in his book, Amazing Grace, that three-quarters of all the inmates in New York State prisons come from seven neighborhoods. I don't think anyone in this room would want our children to be raised in those seven neighborhoods, nor would we have much of a chance if we were there to raise healthy children in the context of the cycles of poverty, crime, violence, despair, hopelessness, drugs. That pervade those neighborhoods. What else? What's that?
The new sentencing guidelines that came out after Bush passed the drug law give inordinately long sentences for drug offenses.
Okay, so we have within the three strikes and you're out kind of provisions and other guidelines for sentencing guidelines that really hit users of drugs very, very heavily.
Linked with the person who said harassment by police, the justice system in general does not deal the same with people of color as people who are not.
Okay, so the justice system doesn't deal the same with all groups. Okay.
Needs of self-worth are found in gangs rather than at home.
Okay, I mentioned, and where I'm going to talk about this a lot more next time, that if you were to ask me, force me to narrow it down, why aren't families doing very well, I would say it's the absence of community. And that there's all kinds of things that go into that. And it's interesting where people are looking for community. And that's certainly one of the places. Okay, well, thank you. That's very, very helpful. And I just want to tell a couple of stories and offer a couple of things, and then we'll open it up for a broader conversation. It was very striking to me. 2 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago. I was in South Africa about a month after Nelson Mandela became the president, assumed the presidency of South Africa. And when I was there, I went and I saw a play in Johannesburg. It was put on by an all-black male theater company, and the title of the play was called Josie Josie. And it was about the new South Africa, in quotes. This was one of the harshest self-critiques that I had ever seen in a play. Because what the play showed over and over and over again were blacks committing violence against blacks. Robbery, you know, theft, murder, deception, trickery, all kinds of things. And my interpretation of the play, in a nutshell, was this was a really, really interesting self-critique, because what these actors were saying is that South Africa was now finally free. Apartheid was finally broken. But the apartheid system had destroyed so much of the community, of the hope, of the prospects for life for all these black South Africans. And it was a really harsh kind of self-critique saying, yeah, we're free, but this is apartheid's legacy. Now, what was interesting, this was a very interesting play anyway, but I was sitting next to two white South Africans, and they were watching this play, and for them, they were seeing their worst fears about the new South Africa lived out before them. This was their fear of what South Africa was going to be like now that it's being ruled by blacks. But what was very interesting in talking to them, they saw no relationship between what was being acted out on the stage and the legacy of apartheid. What was being acted out on the stage for them was the genetic deficiency of blacks in South Africa. And as I was walking out of the theater, their parting comment to me was, I think your blacks are more civilized than ours. Now, I tell that story because in the present welfare debate, another one of the main voices is a man named Charles Murray. And Charles Murray wrote a book along with this other man, I forget his name, called The Bell Curve. And what their book does, they got tremendous play in the press, and they're on all the talk shows now, is that blacks are poor in our country because they're genetically inferior. And that low IQ scores are caused by genetics, not by poverty. And it was a message just in time for the November 1994 elections. And it told, I think, a lot of voters kind of exactly what they were afraid to say themselves. These authors spoke. And it was, again, one of the things that we have to come to terms with, I think, is that in our society, poverty is disproportionate on those who are people of color. That doesn't mean that they're, I'm going to talk in a few minutes about how widespread poverty is, but it's important that we try to come to terms with why. I live in Minneapolis. People, when I usually say that, some of you, anybody else from Minneapolis, a couple people here from Minneapolis, I know, friends of mine and others. Whenever I tell people I'm from Minneapolis, the usual response is, it's a really nice city. And my response to that response is, yeah, it really is a nice city in a lot of ways. It's got these wonderful lakes. It still has some strong neighborhoods. It's had reasonably progressive mayor leadership. It has a lot of things. But in my city, over half of the children, probably closer to 60% of the children that live in my city, live in poverty. More than half of the children who go to the public schools that my children attend live in poverty. It's a nice city, but it's one of the most segregated cities in the country. And it's a city in which, if you are a person of color, you are more likely to be poor in Minneapolis, Minnesota, than any other major city in the country. It's not part of a legacy that we normally promote in our brochures, right? But it's a part of the reality. And what concerns me is that it's very, very difficult, I mean, it's very, very easy for us to begin to confuse problems associated with poverty, to project those as factors of race, when people of color are disproportionately poor and thus subjected to the conditions of poverty. And where that came up for me really clearly was with my daughter Hannah in her kindergarten class a few years ago. There was a student in her class that I call in this book Dion. And she, you know, we were really thrilled. Hannah was doing well. She was a very young kindergarten, but she seemed to be doing fine. If she ever had anything negative to say, it was about Dion. And I learned fairly quickly that Dion was an African-American boy, and I was already worried, you know, projecting, oh no, my daughter's going to be a racist. How am I going to explain that to, you know, everybody? So anyway, I volunteered in the classroom a number of times, and I worked with Dion. And Dion, or the teacher asked me to work with Dion, it was a public Montessori school, in a relatively simple task of putting pegs in a color sequence. Like white peg, blue peg, what comes next? White peg, blue peg. And working with Dion, he could not get this. He could not concentrate, he could not do it. And I wondered, well, what's going on with Dion? Well, the last day of school, I sat with his mother at a school picnic, and she told me that her other son was in the hospital with severe lead poisoning.
Lead poisoning.
That they had been evicted and been living in a shelter for the last 4 months. And that she just looked at Dion with sadness and said, I think maybe it's affected him too. But the point of this story is, I mean, that's the tragic legacy of what poverty does. And there are lots of Dions in in the public schools in Minneapolis. And the tragedy is they may never catch up. They may never catch up. But from the perspective of our children, I think we have to be very careful because Hannah's prejudice, if it was prejudice, I'll put that in quotes, towards Dion, had nothing to do with the fact that he was black. It had to do with all the things that she came to school with, Dion left behind. Enthusiasm, hope, clarity, ability to read, a love of books, ability to concentrate, all those things. And so we have to be very careful. And I think in our society, it's pretty easy to confuse those. Just a couple of other things. Interestingly enough, this last May, I guess it was, maybe those of you who live in Minneapolis can help me, but we've gone to a system now where the idea is teachers are really taking it on the chin. I don't know if that's true where you live, but it certainly is true where we live. We are blaming teachers for the failure to teach our students. And personally, I see a lot of really good teachers struggling amidst enormous odds of working with students like Dion, for example. So in Minneapolis now, in Minnesota now, we have this program where they're going to do testing. And students will have to pass basic math and reading tests in order to get a degree. Well, we've been in a couple of years of preparation for this, and they tested the eighth graders. And I don't have the exact statistics, but I think it was 37% of Minneapolis students passed the reading test. 37%. And it was a little higher past the math.
42,
thank you. Ask the man. Well, this is pathetic, right? not anything to be proud of. But then someone came along and they corrected, or they did a they looked at those scores and looked at it in the context of poverty. And they looked at the scores of those students, black and white, who were not poor. And they did as well or better as their suburban counterparts. So non-poor students, black and white, Asian, Native American, if you were non-poor and you were going to the public school in Minneapolis, you did as well or better as the best students in the white suburbs. But if you factored in poverty, overall 37% passed the reading test. It's a pretty, I think, compelling statement, again, about if we want children to learn, if we want families to do well, then we have to address this fundamental issue of inequality and poverty that's ravaging the country. Okay. I just want to read one paragraph, and then I'm going to open it up for conversation here. This is my take on why it's important that we talk directly about issues of race and poverty. I write, it is important to talk about race and poverty because under the cover of such tensions, Republican administrations in the 1980s fleeced much of the electorate, doing immeasurable damage to families, neighborhoods, and our economic future in the process. Social programs were cut, the value of the minimum wage eroded, taxes were shifted onto poor and working class people, the national debt skyrocketed along with military spending and tax breaks for the wealthy. Casino capitalism drained pensions and tore communities apart, gaps between the rich and the poor widened, and the middle class was squeezed. And I go on to give some statistics about that, but what I see happening is that a lot of middle-class whites, people not unlike ourselves, are feeling fairly insecure about the future for lots of reasons. Reasons of what's happening with our children, reasons with what's going on in the economy. Five U.S. companies, just five, eliminated 341,000 jobs in a three-year period. Just five U.S. companies. And in the context of that insecurity, I think what is happening in our country is there's a tremendous amount of energy going into focusing on the poor, and it's taking attention away from what the rich have been doing, from the policies of the 1980s to the present, that are redistributing wealth continuously upward, creating these huge divisions between rich and the poor, economic insecurity among many. And as long as we allow that to happen, our neighborhoods and our society is going to continue to fracture, it seems to me. So I'll stop there, and we have time for a little bit of discussion here. Yes?
You said that in the 70s and 80s, the Republican, they didn't control the legislature, so therefore they couldn't pass anything.
Well, one of the things...
It was a Republican administration, but they could, the Republicans, it was, all the legislation was controlled by the Democrats.
Well, the 1980s is a point well taken. And just two comments. I talk in this book, and I use a particular analysis of the 1980s in terms of the election provided in a, I forget the name of the book, but the writers, their last name, it's the Edsels. And they talk about how a lot of traditionally Democratic voters shifted over to the Republican Party and basically made the Reagan Revolution possible. And so it starts there, but two important correctives, and you'll see if you read this book that I have only slightly less disdain for many of the policies that have been carried out by Democratic senators, congresspeople, and presidents. And in fact, to make your point, there's a wonderful book that some of you may have heard of. It's called The Politics of Rich and Poor. It's written by a Republican strategist by the name of Kevin Phillips. I talk about this in the book Brave New World Order. And Kevin Phillips, as a Republican strategist, looks at the 1980s and talks about these incredible wealth transfers that took place in the 1980s. And basically, his concern as a Republican was, if the Democrats or anybody would simply tell the truth about what happened in the 1980s, the Republicans would be thrown out on their butts. That's his concern as a Republican strategist. But he said, it may not happen because so many of the Democrats have bought into the same logic, the same system, approved the same policies. So that what, you know, in a nutshell, what we really need is something much more progressive, much more child-friendly, much more progressive than either of the political parties are offering us right now, in my view. Another comment or question?
Yeah, I think, you know, as you noted, the welfare system is flawed. I think we can all agree with that. But the right seems to have all the intellectual initiative. I mean, they say, they make the analogy of, you know, throwing people on welfare into the swimming pool and letting them sink or swim. And people who don't like the mean-spiritedness of that fact, they feel uncomfortable defending the status quo. So what's your prescription for welfare reform?
First of all, a response to a possible comeback to something like that is, I firmly believe, based on where I live at least, that my children can't be safe in Minneapolis unless there's greater justice. Unless we find a way of sharing resources more equitably in society and dealing with some of the social causes of crime and other things. So my rejoinder would be, really all of us have a stake in making the society more fair unless we think that we're going to survive behind barbed wire fences, which doesn't seem like a very pleasant way of living. In terms of a prescription for a welfare reform, I'll talk more about that maybe next time, or tomorrow morning at 10:30, but let me just say a couple things. Welfare reform should include efforts to create living wage jobs. And we can either do that through the marketplace, or we can do it through a combination of marketplace and earned income tax credit, where you supplement the incomes of the working poor. It needs to include access to childcare. It needs to include, I think we desperately need in this country, probably the one single thing that we could do that would be of most benefit to almost all families in this country would be to have nationalized health insurance, to have health care available to all. If we had prioritized just those three things, health care, access to good, meaningful daycare, and living wage jobs or ways of supplementing the incomes of the working poor, we would take tremendous steps towards improving the well-being and options for lots of families as well. So that's the short answer, and tomorrow maybe we can get into a longer answer. Thank you very much.